an interview with Martin Travis, former chairman of the Department of Political Science, in my office, October 22nd, 87.
My name is Martin Travis, Department of Political Science professor and director of the Summer Institute of American Studies. I came to Stony Brook in the fall of 1961. I'm not sure how old I was at that time.
When were you born?
I was born in 1917, September. I came from Stanford University and as a professor, associate professor of political science.
Who was chairman of the Department of Political Science then?
Professor Robert Walker.
Walker?
And I was interviewed by Dean Sidney Gelber and the then president. Who was the first?
Lee.
Yes.
John Lee.
I came both for the reason and desire of coming back east, of being a little regretful of the nature of the public schools in California and being closer to my research in Washington, D.C., not to mention salary. Well, at the time I came, the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook were changing. It was originally established as a needed a Long Island institution of higher learning, and it was designed to be a four-year college, a liberal arts college. The time I came, its mission had changed. It was changing from a interdepartmental science and arts oriented to a departmental graduate institution. It was being transferred, formed into reality with the organization of new departments, but the original professors resisted the new mission, and I found myself in a conflictual situation.
Can you be more specific about that? What was the nature of the conflict?
Well, the original people who...
They were divisionally oriented.
Were divisions, and I think President Lee had just arrived that last spring on campus and was to depart, be removed from office in the following October after I arrived. Before that, the college was headed by, I think, Dean Carlson.
Olson. Yes, Dean Olson.
Who had come down from Albany. The nature of the conflict was those members of the staff that were looking forward to a major graduate institution and those that had looked forward to more of a great books undergraduate liberal arts center. Mm-hmm. As at the time, I felt that the conflict was over ideas. I now think it was more a matter of the group that had been in power losing it and the new group assuming it.
I see. Okay, who was the leader of the new group, would you think?
Well, I was projected in as one of the leaders of the new group. I certainly didn't seek that position, but in that group were Sid Gelber and, of course, the new president, and Fran Bonner, and
Irvine, Tom.
And Tom Irvine. And Ed Feast was in it to some extent.
I see.
But not Ed was not playing an active role, really.
Right. Right. Frank Erk was on the other side?
Yes, but not too active.
Yeah.
He seemed to be more diplomatic in his positions that he took.
Who were the leaders on the other side, aside from Olson?
Well, one of the more articulate ones was Ben Nelson.
Ben Nelson, sociology.
And sociology. Michael Parenti, who was a junior assistant professor and also lived in the dormitories over there, and also was responsible for a faculty leader for student strikes when they occurred.
I see.
Jay Williams was very much on that side.
Mm-hmm.
He had been the first chairman of the political science department for a month or two when the new reorganization took place and he resigned.
I see. Where did Walker come from? Walker's a new name to me in political science.
Oh, Bob Walker?
Yeah.
And in Stanford.
He came from Stanford.
No, he was the chairman of... Oh, you mean, you asked who was the chairman here when I came?
Yes.
Nobody. I was brought in as chairman.
As chairman. Oh, I see.
And they asked me to be chairman, and I had not... in my interviews had not met anybody in the political science department before I was appointed. There were only two.
I see.
One was Jay and the other was Parenti. And so I said reluctantly I'd be an acting chairman until I got a sense of the community. And I was an acting chairman indeed until you became acting president and appointed me a regular chairman.
I see. Well, I think that was one of the good things I did.
Well, I feel grateful.
Number eight.
Well, Stony Brook, or rather Oyster Bay when I arrived, was very much in turmoil. The students were rioting and were not happy with the new direction. And in October, as I said, the recently appointed President Lee was dismissed by Albany. And an acting president, Harry Porter.
Yeah, he was provost in the central office.
Formerly
president of Fredonia.
That's right. He reluctantly came down to campus.
Yeah.
And as soon as he could, which was the following summer, was able to recruit you to replace him. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of a settling influence, I noticed, mm-hmm. on campus, to the point where a lot of us were so grateful to you, we petitioned you to be our full president. You remember that?
I remember something.
We had a committee meeting, a group of us did, and we thought this would be the most stabilizing influence that Stony Brook could have, and you refused.
Well, I didn't quite think it was that way. I have a document signed by Ted Goldfarb that went up to Albany, and I tried to get him not to send it because I'd had past experience of being the golden-haired boy of the fair-haired boy of the faculty at another institution. And while the president was on leave, and was accused of being the leader of that, which I was not, by some of the members of the trustees. And I didn't want to go through that thing again.
Well, this, of course, was a different proposition because there was no one else that, at the time, that was an active candidate.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I was only supposed to be here for a year.
Were you going to return to Bucknell?
No, I was going to return to Albany.
I see.
I joined the university's system as executive dean in the Albany office immediately on detail down here.
I see.
For a year, until they could find a president.
And you were acting president for?
Three
years.
Because Tom Hamilton resigned a week after I got here. He was the one who had appointed me. He resigned as of December 31st of 62. And it took Frank Moore about 18 months to find Sam Gould. Meanwhile, various people were brought in.
I think Tom Hamilton was, as I heard the story, forced to resign, and in part because of his role in firing Lee. Governor Rockefeller at the time was unhappy with that and made room for Lee when he left here in the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, I believe, or one of the Rockefeller.
Yeah, it was the one out of Washington that was development,
yes.
Something of the sort.
That's it.
Anyway.
Okay.
What events, what persons? Well, what about the faculty? You say it was split. And let's get away from 61, if you can, and talk about 62 to 65, because a lot of these interviews have focused heavily on Oyster Bay and seem to have forgotten the first 3 years before John Toll came.
Well, personally, those first 3 years, I think, of the new campus, I the old war of words continued, but in diminished by a great deal. But I, as acting chairman, and then subsequently chairman of the political science department, was confronted with the problem of Michael Parenti, who continued for a short time, at least, to be active with against my administration and enlisting support from other members of the faculty, including a mathematics professor whose name was Martin.
Yes.
And at one point, Martin prepared a two-page, single-spaced memorandum addressed to the faculty, and which was flattering to me in a sense because it suggested I was the most powerful person on campus and that I was not doing justice for one Michael Parenti. And I think Martin at that point was on just leaving for the Peace Corps in Africa. And this was his parting.
He had caused Harry Porter, who really took charge of his case. No end of grief and wasted time. And he was a perfect example of the way an institution failed to save itself some trouble by not screening him back on the previous job If they'd done that, they would have known that, that the chap was a little bit off base, a little bit of a crackpot.
Well, I think the university would have saved itself some trouble, too, by doing the same thing with Parenti. When I left for the summer, after Harry Porter had come down, he assured me that Parenti would be continued only for 2 years. But he gave him a full three-year renewal.
No.
And but the last year of Parenti's teaching at Stony Brook, he had moved to the city, had remarried, and was only spending either Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday. And so when we made the final decision on his non-renewal, he had distanced himself pretty much from the campus.
He saw it coming, probably.
No, he didn't. Because he suddenly gathered a file and gave it to, directed again against me, and gave the entire file to a Martin Buskin, who...
Oh, newspaper, Newsday.
Yes, in Newsday.
Yes.
And Martin,
that's typical.
And Martin Buskin subsequently told Bernard Semmel, who happened to be commuting from the city and happened to be sitting next to him one day, that he began to realize then that Parenti was not a reliable source for news.
Well, I found that the carrying on of the feud in the newspapers was a source of irritation and kind of bewilderment as far as I was concerned. Buskin came in, and I think I kind of straightened him out. He asked me some questions that obviously had been planted, and I think that after a while he... this whole newspaper business calmed down.
I think a turning point, there were two turning points from my experience here. The first was your arrival, and the tensions had reached such a point before you came. It took all of your diplomacy and time, which was 3 years, that the second turning point, I thought, was the arrival of Johnny Toole, but with him, his suddenly our newsworthiness became different. It appeared in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And suddenly we were no longer the
strife-torn
campus.
Campus,
yes.
Right.
Yeah.
We had looked at John Toole for the deanship of the graduate school. Remember that?
Yeah. And didn't not for the was it for the, yes, for the graduate school. Yeah.
We had that line.
Yeah.
And I tried to tell Harry that if we were going to go into graduate work, we ought to get ourselves a first-rate dean.
We did the same thing with I understand the same thing was done for Lee. He was looked at as the dean of the School of Engineering.
That's right.
And
okay. Did you have any conferences between 62 and 65 in the field of the social sciences that you remember? Were we active in organizing anything outside the departments? Like this thing? Like the Nixon business?
No. We weren't. We were so preoccupied with growth, with recruiting,
right.
And I was still pretty active in my first two summers that I was here. I took off to teach in Mexico because they were prior commitments. And I was still active in research in Washington, D.C.
Work you were doing?
That particular work was subsidized part by the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. And it was a study of the Legal Advisor's Office in the Department of State. It sort of was both political and legal, and it crossed both my interests in teaching. And so I was preoccupied with that, too.
Well, what were your interests in teaching?
Well, at that point in time, when I came here, I was teaching a course in American foreign policy, and a course in international law, and Latin American politics, which I had been teaching and publishing in for, I did publish in for 24 years. But, so, in terms of organizing programs like this, it didn't occur to any of us that
to do it.
The time was right.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, let's see.
Some of the, in building that department, we were successful in some of our recruits. One of them, Sandy Lakoff, became a special assistant to President Toll and was the originator of the idea of naming the dormitories as colleges and having reducing the size of a huge university to more like the Harvard college form. And of course Howard Scarrow arrived. He was a former graduate student, a teaching assistant of mine at Duke University.
Were you at Duke?
I taught at Duke for 4 years.
Is that right?
Before I taught at Stanford.
You recruited Howard?
I brought Howard, yes.
Good. Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
Let's see.
Were any of your the members of your department active in the Senate or active in faculty organization? What can you say about faculty life?
Well, I was the only one that was overactive in faculty life in those days. It seemed, as I recall it, I was over committee. I was on the curriculum committee. I was on the graduate committee. We didn't have a special senate, as I remember. We had the faculty meeting as a senate.
We had a faculty meeting. That's right.
Yes.
Right.
And I remember each one of those committees in which Ben Nelson participated was long and tedious, and it always included a monologue by Ben.
Yes, right. Now, I don't know when he came, or I know nothing really about his appointment. Do you have any idea?
He must have come at least 2 years before I arrived.
Before you did, 59.
I also recruited Stan Ross.
Did you?
He was in the field of Latin America.
Yes.
And it was clear when Dick Morris,
yes,
was the chairman of the history department and shared my interest at that time in Latin America. And Dick, he knew he was leaving for Yale, and we were both interested in having someone in the history department for Latin America, and also with the idea that Stan might become dean. And if you recall, you appointed Stan dean.
Yes, I know. And the reason I appointed him was that in talking over with him, prospective candidates for the history department. I liked the way he handled the search process and the kind of criteria he had for screening his candidates. And, you know, I was appointed acting chief administrative officer and dean of arts and sciences.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I soon felt that I couldn't effectively wear two hats. I thought it was just foolish. So I decided we ought to have a dean. And I'm not sure that I gave sufficient thought to going outside and getting a dean from outside. I thought Stan would do a good job. What do you think about the job he did?
I thought it was terrible. And I'd always blame myself for it because I recruited him with half an eye that he might indeed become a dean. And I think when we were entertaining him at Sunwood, in those days we took him to Sunwood and would have dinner at the Three Village Inn and then spend the night there.
Yeah.
I think I may well have mentioned this to him as a possibility. And it was very clear that he very much would like to be a dean at the time. That should have made me suspicious of when I saw that he wanted it that much. But I think...
Why do you think he did a terrible job?
Well, I think, first place, I think a good dean should have try to develop and recruit a balanced faculty. And it's clear that he gave special preference to one department, and within that department, he gave special preference to one field. Well, I myself wanted Latin America to be represented. I think it was very much overrepresented by the time he was finished recruiting. I think also he had a personality that was not the easiest for not only his own department, but for others to deal with regularly. And in those days, when the whole university was small, it was all of us got to know each other better than sometimes we wanted to know.
Okay. Well, I wonder how he handled the scientists. You're judging from the way he handled your department and any others?
Well, in those days, the social sciences and the humanities were all housed along with your office in one building. So I don't have an idea. I don't recall. I'm sure I talked with people like Bonner and other scientists because I knew them well. And I'm sure that I don't feel that I was alone in this judgment of Stan. Stan's aspirations for within Stony Brook, I think, were higher than that of the dean. And I think one reason that he was prompted to leave for Texas was that he didn't see a future here at a higher administrative level. Although he put his name in as a candidate for president when
here. All right.
I think
I didn't know that.
You might confirm that. I think Sid Gelber told me that, and he was on the screening committee for that one.
I see. Okay. Well, you were on the graduate committee then. You remember our talking with Malcolm Muir and Lester Evans of the Commission on Education for the Health Sciences.
Okay.
Do you remember talking, do you remember Harry Porter bringing me in to meet with a group of individuals? I don't know who they were.
That you were here when I returned from teaching in Mexico in the summer of 62. So was that...
It was in
the summer?
August, I think, yes, something like that.
And I returned in September.
I see, then you weren't part of the group then.
No.
Okay.
I wish I could say I were, because it was an excellent choice.
Well, that's nice to have some people think that way. Well, I was somewhat amused and a bit puzzled, because I was simply presented as a fait accompli to these people. And
well, you must have remembered Ben Nelson if he were in the group.
At the time, few people stood out. Tsujishi was there in Bradfield, and I know that Alec Pond was there. Who else? I don't
know. No, Alec couldn't have been there.
Yes, Alec walked out with me after the meeting, because he was chairman of the Department of Physics. He came the same time I did.
Oh, I helped. Arnie Feingold recruited him. And I remember a party at Arnie's house in which I met Alec for the first time.
I see.
That's right. I somehow was, and it was Alec that recruited Johnny Toll.
I think he certainly put his name in the end of the hopper. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Right. He certainly recruited him in the sense that I think he was responsible for his coming first to be considered as dean of the faculty.
That's right.
Or dean of the graduate school.
Graduate.